But maybe even they have a manual that you could look through to see if it could do that. But I wouldn't say one way or the other without knowing more information here. It does say it's self-calibrating, but to what standard, what they mean by that. Back to you, Dick.
I got the manual, Dick. Yeah, I kind of thought that manual was going to be downloadable. Wait till the beam's up. There it goes.
The computer connection to actually now what I've discovered is the 226 is the later version. They don't distribute the 225 anymore, and that's typical of MSJ. And the USB connector on it is for uploading new firmware. Yeah, you can use your PC to command the analyzer, and it will make, let's see, the band, will choose the number of bandwidth, it'll measure 127 points and download it as a CSV file, so, I don't see them even mentioning software in which you can do a graphical display or anything like that. They talk about the computer connection to be able to either do one or two things. You command the unit and make it do what you want, and you read the results off the screen, or you can get 128 points in comma-separated format and utilize the data from that. So, and that's out of the MFJ manual that I'm scrolling through right here. P2RWK2J.
Is that the 225 manual you've looked at?
226, which is the later version of the 225.
226,
which is the later version of the 225.
W-H-U-S-A-Y, Doug, when you found out about this software, IG Mini VNA, did that software indicate which MFJ antenna analyzers it was compatible with? How did you find out about that software? And by the method, by whatever method you found out about that software, did it give you a hint as to which of the MFJ products it will directly connect to? W-H-U-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W, go ahead, Doug.
Hi, am I getting through?
KC2QFJ, recognize, we'll get to you in a second. Doug, you're getting through, go right ahead, Doug.
Okay, I have what's called a instruction manual for this device. MFJ Graphical Antenna Analyzer, and the model number and everything. The 226 is not an upgrade from this, it's a different animal. It works differently, it looks different, it's got a different kind of case. And I don't think that 226 is actually a VNA of any kind, but I'm not sure. But the 225 is sold as a VNA as well as a antenna analyzer, and it has a USB power source and with IG Min VNI testing, it says. So you select the USB power source and use it with the IG Mini VNA testing. It has two jacks, one output, one input, and it claims to be able to measure S11 and S21. It doesn't say anything about S22 or obviously it must measure S11.
I found it
at this far bridge. But it doesn't tell you what the freeware does because it says it's not supplied by FMFJ, and it doesn't tell you anything about the instructions for its use, and it says in addition to all that, it's in French. I downloaded it anyway, but I haven't got anything to plug it into, so I can't test it.
Got it, Dick. Okay, wait for the beeps and you've got it, Eric.
The 226 is a single point, the 225 is a dual point. So it can do a lot of stuff. It's got a DDS that you can make go. It's a nice box. And it's only $300. Let's see. got good mixers, got two directional couplers. Could do anything. Well, let me see if I can find the software that goes with it. So, there we go. Give me a minute while I read the instruction manual. On here's the freeware. Okay, let's see what that actually is. Give me a minute. K2RW, K2JET.
I think you earlier said that the 225, you just now said it's a beautiful box, but I think you said it's a discontinued product. Is that true, Eric?
From what I see, no, that's not true. This is a continuous product. I looked at someone else's comments, that's where I got that from. But, let me open this up. And give me another minute.
Okay, while Eric is doing that, we'll go over to Steve. Wait for the four beeps first, Steve. KC2 QFJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Somebody signed in, called KC2 QFJ. Are you still there, Steve? Are you still there?
Yes, this is Steve. I'm KC2 QFJ. I'm on Echolink. We don't hear the beeps on Echolink. But I was going to say exactly what Eric found is that the 225 is currently on MFJ's website. But I do know that the IG Mini VNA software that you mentioned, the software that comes with the hardware device Mini VNA, which is made by a company, I think it's called Mini Radio Systems. And so I guess it's freeware, and it apparently also works with MFJ device. I don't have any personal experience with it, but there's an excellent YouTube channel called TRX Bench that I would recommend to all the TechNet listeners anyway for a lot of good repair videos. And he has a couple of videos that I haven't looked at yet regarding using the Mini VNA.
Very fine, Steve, and thank you for that information. And by the way, where we were told earlier that the 225 antenna analyzer contains a BNC input connector and a UHF output connector. Those are the connectors that go directly to the coax cable that makes the measurement of your antenna. What we're trying to find out, is there a digital connector, another auxiliary connector that gives you...
Yes, there's a USB connector, and I found the IG Mini DNA software, so give me another second, I'll tell you what it does.
Sounds good, Eric. We'll stand by for the beeps and wait to find out what you just found. Sounds like it is a compatible combination. Fantastic.
It's written in French, too.
And you speak French. Wait for the beeps.
K2RAW. Dick, could I ask my question on that quarter wave action transformer?
Not now. You're gonna have to wait for your turn, Howie. Go ahead, there, Eric.
Alright, I've got this up here. What it does, the software essentially gives you better resolution of what you get off the screen. And it does it does everything. It does, it allows you to put markers in. It seems it only lets you do two markers. But I actually have the RSC Mini VNA, and I can put eight markers in. I can do a whole lot of stuff. So for $300, this thing is great. Although my VNA goes up to a gig, this only goes up to, 200 or something like that. Sorry to keep you hanging here. It goes up to 180 megahertz. That's it. Doesn't do UHF at all.
Yeah, I'm a guy who, way back in the late 60s, early 70s, when Hewlett-Packard first came out with a vector network analyzer, In those days, the thing was so clunky, required so many external components and calibrations and external sweeper and everything else, and it was a nightmare to use. And I really started off with a real hate of vector network analyzers. And along came Roden Schwartz, and in 1980 or 82, I was introduced to their ZVC, Zebra Victor Charlie 0 to 8 gigahertz vector network analyzer. I think it's a $40,000 box, brand new. And my goodness, is that thing user-friendly? It gives you a ridiculous amount of 70 dB dynamic range, many digits of resolution, beautiful high-resolution screen. You can set the screen to give you one display or four displays simultaneously, overlapping on each other, or as four separate pictures that are tiled across the screen with S11, S12, S21, S22, and so on, all being updated every 30 milliseconds. What a machine. So, if you're willing to spend the money, there are vector network analyzers out there that will almost give you a cup of coffee on request, if you know what I mean. Fantastic machines that come a long way.
$10,000, you can get a little box that hooks up to the computer for me, Tektronix, or a Pure Packet, or a few others that does everything that the $40,000 and $50,000 job does.
Yeah, thank you, Eric, and that is the modern trend. This is a great big box with a great big screen on it and so on. Very convenient. Whereas the more portable, cheaper ones nowadays, I think you said for $10,000 you can get all of that, or maybe even cheaper yet. So we're progressing. In the old days of doing laboratory measurements, what an engineer had to do is he had to scout around for a signal generator, hopefully a sweeping signal generator. Scout around for a frequency meter so you can calibrate the sweeping generator. Scout around for the crystal detector, the directional coupler, the oscilloscope, and hook all that jazz up on a bench in order to make a swept measurement of a device on the test. It took you half a day to gather the equipment and to calibrate it and hook it all up and have the right amount of interfacing cables and whatever. Big rigmarole. Nowadays, all of those functions with logarithmic display and huge dynamic range, I mean, a crystal detector, you can get nowhere near that amount of dynamic range as you get out of a log IF these days. So we've come a long way. One box, and the calibration procedure for that box is even getting very simple also. So don't be afraid of vector network analyzers. It does, let me drop it. It does have a considerable learning curve. The S parameters, as they're called, S11, stands for input reflection coefficient. You and I know that as standing wave ratio, but it's in the unit of reflecting voltage. That's what S11 is. S stands for scattering. So the four S parameters are so-called scattering parameters. You're applying a signal to a device on the test, and that device on the test is going to scatter it in some way. Some of it goes forward to the antenna or through the rest of the amplifier. Some of it reflects back toward the signal generator, so to speak. That's the kind of scattering they're talking about. That's how it's got its name. And so you start reading articles on scattering parameters and the way they're written from a technical point of view will scare the hell out of you. And the way it's taught in colleges will turn you off unless you're willing to really dig into it. But once we amateurs have a slight understanding of what standing wave ratio really is, and that is one of the methods of display of so-called S11, and a polar display of that reflected signal really is a so-called Smith chart, all of a sudden it becomes a hell of a lot easier to understand. And if you're doing an antenna alignment with a sweeping device, my goodness, that can save you years, literally years of testing time. To do the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Let me drop this. Chapter 4 of almost every issue, except for the first issue, which is Chapter 3, of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the real Bible of antenna engineering. 5,000 kinds of antennas are in there. Chapter 4 shows you these Brown and Woodward curves, which, by the way, are on the two websites that are associated with the TechNet. I call them Mike Number 1 and Mike Number 2. Amateurradio.tangovictor is the one first one, and LimeOnTechNet.com is the second one by Mike Number 1, KC2NJI, and K1MJN is Mike Number 2. All right, so you can see the Brown and Woodward curves. Brown and Woodward curves are every every possible diameter, every possible length of a dipole or monopole, what is the real measured impedance. Brown and Woodward did that in 1945. It's in every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, arguably the most valuable curves that are in that book. The equation they give you for a dipole, do not use it. It has more error than reality. Whereas these real measured curves, Mr. Brown and Woodward, they probably spent more than a man year gathering that data that's on those two graphs. One graph is the resistive component, the other graph is the reactive component. For every possible length, every possible diameter, every reasonable frequency of a dipole or monopole-like structure, it took them a man year to measure all of that data with the equipment that was available to them in that day. Let me drop. A well-equipped guy today with a vector network analyzer can measure all of that data in one day. And if he's got samples of the individual monopoles of the right diameter and just monopoles of a bunch of different diameters, if he's got them sitting on the table, he can gather all of that data in 1 hour, as opposed to a man year or maybe 2 man years of 2 top-notch engineers at Bell Laboratories in 1945. We've come a long way, as you can tell. And with any further questions on vector vision, who is that?
That's just me. I have one more comment here.
Go ahead, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
No, there's one thing that disturbs me about this after reading the manual. Okay, typically you would do OSL on a good VNA. This thing that says calibration is very seldom needed but easy to execute. Calibration check is done by removing any load from the output. So basically their calibration is done. Calibration plane errors, when it calibrates, it self-calibrates, it says OSL internally at the connector, which kind of disturbs me a little bit, so that's a negative, but the rest of it looks pretty good. And it does not, actually, the software does not display a Smith check. So what the software does is it gives you a more fine, accurate display, because it's got an LCD display that's actually nice if you're working out in the field, but I wouldn't want to use it as a measuring instrument. K2RIW, K2Z.
Are you saying, Eric, that the only method of display is an XY chart? It does not have a polar chart capability? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Wait for the beeps.
That's what it looks like, because they don't seem to mention it anywhere. And on the actual software, which they show you a picture of, there's no button there to get you to a Smith chart.
Because it's called an antenna analyzer, and because most of the antennas you and I use, Eric, are connected by way of a transmission line from the shack to the antenna. And the antenna might be in the shack with you, or it might be on the top of the tower. It doesn't matter. So you're using a transmission line, part of your system going to the antenna. You then bring that transmission line directly up to the type N connector on the MFJ antenna analyzer. Therefore, if it only calibrates at that connector for the way we use it 95% of the time, that's good enough. And by the way, to calibrate, to do a full calibration of a one-port vector network analyzer, usually you do that with you first sweep it with a pure open circuit, then with a pure short circuit, then with an ideal good 50-ohm dummy load, and if the software in there is smart enough, it takes those three recordings, crunches them just right, and now you're calibrated across that frequency range at that connector for anything you connect to that connector. What Eric is a little bit unhappy about is I'm going to put a test cable from that connector over to my RF amplifier that I want to measure. Then now you're getting a little bit of error because of the cable characteristics, unless you're smart enough to make that cable some number of half, exactly half wavelength long. Is that the approximately the way you see it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
Kinda. I mean, this box is designed to plug into whatever your antenna is and make your measurements. I use it for more than that kind of stuff. And my test cables, especially when I'm working at, you know, at higher frequencies, it becomes important to me. You know, I've got very accurate calibrated loads that I use on my VNA and a short and an open. And it does make a difference when you get up there. But again, they call this thing a MFJ graphical antenna analyzer. So, you know, it does what it's supposed to do for what it's doing. And I'm asking for it to do more.
And to NPR. It's got the right name. Go ahead, Steve. And no, that's NPR is, what was it? That's John. Wait for the four beeps and go right ahead, John.
Okay, connected to connectors are 239, and maybe Eric mentioned the other one, which is got here is 239, and then the other one is an SMA. There we go. Okay, SMA, and also it's listed. Okay, this is a man. In price, it's $399.95, not $2. Back to you, Dick, and to NPR.
Any idea what the SMA connector is doing? The UHF connector is probably where you connect your antenna cable that you want to measure the antenna going to it. What does the SMA do? Is that for an external source of signal? Anybody know? K2RIW?
Sure,
okay,
I'm looking for the thing in use here, a diagram anyway. The fat output jack here goes to a DIA device under test. There's an arrow that says a signal path, and the output of that device under test goes to the input jack, whatever that jack may actually be. Oh, it says it's an SMA.
What does the SMA connector do, Doug? Doug, what does the SMA connector do?
For 2-1 measurements.
Wow. Interesting. That's a lot more than an antenna analyzer, then. It's really getting into a VNA action. If it's called antenna analyzer, and it can measure S12, what kind of an antenna do you know of, Eric, that has an input connector and an output connector on that single antenna? K2EJ, K2RIW, that's a trick question.
Yeah, it's a trick question. You can use it to measure passive devices. You can probably use it for, I don't know how much input you can provide it, but if you're smart enough, you can use it to measure the bandwidth of an amplifier or whatever. It's a S21 port. So, say for example, you're doing a little LC circuit and you want to see what it looks like, that's the way to go. So the output connector is the output of the DDS, and the input connector is the receive port. So there you go.
Now, Eric, you keep your ear pretty close to the ground of modern-day test equipment. Cost-effectiveness, accuracy, quality, and whatever. I can tell that Doug is possibly on the threshold of buying an antenna analyzer. From what you now know, Eric, is the 225 or the 226 MFJ the one that he should be considering? Or do you know of others that you think would give him a little bit more bang for the dollar? If you were Doug and you had somewhat limited resources, where would you go if you want something like an antenna analyzer? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
No, I'm just learning something here. K2RIW, K2J. I want to see who actually writes the software. MFJ says they don't write the software, so I'm looking that up right now. for the dollar, if you're an HF guy, this is a great box. It's just, it's about as cheap as the meter non-computer, non-VNA type of antenna analyzer. The 226 has the display built in, but it's only single port. The 225 has the two ports, and now, when I get to see what this, what this thing does software-wise, because the MRS radio solutions, that's the mini VNA, that's what I have, and I can take that up to a gig. It actually goes a little over a gig, so. But it's a good bang for the buck. I haven't seen anything cheaper that's got supports on it.
Sounds awful good. That software called IG Mini VNA, if you were able to use it, Doug, it's going to give you some, in theory, high-quality displays, Smith chart and XY plots, whatever, which give you high-resolution, pretty pictures, and great to make a PowerPoint slides if you're going to give a presentation. I don't think that's where you are. You and I were looking for the raw data, whether or not it's displayed on the screen in a slightly chunky manner. As long as the data is there and we can read it, it tells us what we want to know. So whether or not you can interface it with mini VNA may be only icing on the cake, and maybe you don't really need it for what you're trying to do. To B2SAY, for any further comments or questions, K2RIW and TechNet. You got us into a good subject tonight, Doug. Go ahead.
Okay, this is WA2SAY. Well, it's been interesting. I think the last thing I heard from EJ was that the output to this IG Mini VNA freeware, that the freeware does not produce the Smith chart. The question then remains, does the output to the USB port provide enough information so that you could write a little code and make it produce a Smith chart? That's the question that really needs to be answered. But it does look like a nice box, and much more, it's about $40 cheaper than the 226, which definitely does not do all of this. So, I don't know, I'm a little bit up in the air about spending $300 or whatever this latest price for this thing is. But it does look interesting, and I just went through a situation. Let me drop it for a second. I just went through a situation where I had a retune, a massive retune, as a matter of fact, on a 2-meter antenna. I didn't know what happened to it, but I wound up having to do a considerable retune. It didn't take me that long, actually, because it turns out I have, a regular power meter, one of these things with two needles on it, and I have a little handheld 2-meter FM unit from, Motion. I'm just putting the two of them together on the bottom of the antenna and keep pushing the adjustments around, and I tuned it up, so it wasn't all that bad. Anyway, thanks a lot. That was very interesting. WA2SAY, back to that.
So, Eric, do you believe the 225 spits out the right amount of data on its auxiliary connector, by which Doug could write some software if need be to get a Smith chart display? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. I just ran into a guy who made a comparison between this and who is this? He made a comparison between this one and the Ray Solutions, which is a $2,000 box. Pretty close. So, this does not, what I'm seeing is they don't show a Smith chart or anything, but it will give you a CSV of all the points of measurement from that in which you could actually create a Smith chart. It wouldn't be shouldn't be a big deal. Not as accurate as the Array Solutions or the Mini VNA that I have, but it's good enough.
In order for the 225 to know the difference between a reactive load, capacitive or inductive, versus a resistive load, it has to be measuring phase angle of the reflected signal. So if it knows the amplitude of the reflected signal and the phase angle of the reflected signal, all the raw data is there for Smith.
It'll give you a phase angle wherever you put the marker.
Enough. So it's got all the raw data for
it. And it'll give you RS, it'll give you XS, and it'll even convert it to feature phase for you.
So all the raw data to make a Smith chart out of it is there. Yeah, it's $350 or something like that, Doug, but there's a 50-50 chance that you're going to find a MFJ-225 on eBay, used at a considerably cheaper price. You also have the ability to fix electronics after all of your engineering background. Therefore, if you're able to buy from eBay one that is in non-operating condition, you're going to really get a bargain. So consider buying a used one, Doug. Whether or not the front panel is scratched, I don't think bothers you that much. To the A2SAY for a final, K2RIW in the tech net.
Give me a little more.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, it's got a table of stuff like the actual attenuation that the guy used and what it comes up with. He used a 3 dB pad, and this is in transmission mode. The actual MFJ-222 measured 2.7 dB, and at 14 dB it measured 13.3, and at 30 dB it measured 28.8. So, it's not a laboratory instrument, but it's got everything you need in terms of doing an analysis, that's for sure.
Close enough. Over to you for the final, Doug. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, I only hear one beep here. I never did hear four. Anyway, like I said before, thank you for all the information. I haven't really made up my mind. You know, it's a lot of money for just flipping around. But it is a very interesting device, I think. But the only question I tried to raise is that you said if it only puts out the information where the marker is on the screen, you'd have to take a whole batch of separate measurements to find out what was really going on. Anyway, thanks a lot, guys. WA2SAY will be clear and listening out.
The other negative that I see is that it only has fixed bandwidth. It's 118 kilohertz, 591.1 8 megs, and 2.36 megs, and 5 megs, and 11 megs. So you can get by with that, but I like to be able to set the start and stop frequency. You can't do that with it.
Accuracy was already just given. What many of these machines will do is they'll give you a plot of absolute standing wave ratio versus frequency. And usually it's a bathtub-shaped curve, and you and I make modifications to the antenna to make the tip of the bathtub fall in the center of our favorite frequency. That's the main thing you need. And upon each one of those spots on the screen, you go to that dot and say, what's the phase angle? And therefore, you can figure out what a Smith chart would have told you. The Smith chart gives you a little bit more information if you're doing an elaborate kind of antenna design. But the main thing we care about is what does the swept standing wave ratio magnitude look like, which is really a scalar network analyzer function per se. And if we can get the dip low enough to get it on our favorite frequency as we're tweaking the antenna, for most of us, that's good enough. So I'm not convinced you really need Smith chart unless you're doing some very elaborate antenna design and you want to know what you've got to do with that particular sub-element within the antenna. You see what I'm saying on this one, Doug? To be A2SAY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I do. I understand exactly what you're saying, and I tend to agree with you, which is why I have, you know, just not run out and bought one of these things for $300. I do have the capability of producing a measurement, as you say, with the bathtub shape and so forth. If I have a sweep generator, I have directional couplers and stuff, and it's a kludge, but it's something that can be done if I have to.
Very fine, Doug. Let us know in the future what you decide, what you buy, and how well you're happy or unhappy with it. Next person on our list was KC1 SAM. Sam, if you're still with us, go right ahead with your question. KC1 SAM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm here, and I just hear one beep also. I don't hear the four beeps. Yeah, I had a question. I was listening last week, and I couldn't get in last week. I tried, but you guys were a little busy, and my signal was a little weak, I think. My antenna is 50 feet higher this week, and I copy you guys really good. My question was on the on some of the space stuff that you were talking about. Let me break for a second. The comment was about how do we protect from an asteroid speeding towards a planet at 50,000 miles an hour that we don't have anything going that fast to catch it. And I was thinking to myself, why do we have to catch it if it's coming towards us? We just have to get in front of it to deflect it as far out as possible and with whatever we decide to do. But was I missing something in that as far as catching it? Back to you. This is KC1 SAM.
Yeah, you're going through the 975-375 repeater. It only has one beep. And so people who go through the 2585, and by the way, you sound pretty good tonight, so not to worry, Sam. They get all four beeps, so that's some of the explanation. If you do a study of near-Earth objects, and you come to the conclusion that one is heading for us, and it's going to strike us 2 years from now, and it has enough size and enough velocity that it's going to do a lot of damage. It's going to create a miniature nuclear winter, or it's going to blast a hole in the ground in the middle of Manhattan. Once you discover that, and you decide, gee, I don't like that outcome, I want to change that outcome, the only way we know today to change that outcome is to launch some kind of a spacecraft that catches up with that space object and deflects it in some way so that it misses the Earth on the first pass, and if you've done a very intelligent deflection, it's going to miss it for the next 50 passes, if you know what I mean. So you've got to catch up with it in order to deflect it. You don't want to just send a bomb out there and try to blast it away, because that's just going to make a whole lot of individual pieces that are still heading for you, if you know what I mean. So the only defense we know of that's reasonable is to deflect it. If you get to it early enough, moving it 1 foot per second off to the left will, a year and a half later, make it miss the Earth by 100,000 miles, if you know what I mean. So without catching up with it, you can't apply corrective action as we currently know it, Sam. KC1 SAM, K2LIW in the TechNet. Does that make some sense?
KC1 SAM. Oh, very, very much. I understand the concept fully. My point was, we don't have to catch it. It's not like we have to have a rocket going faster than the asteroid in order to catch up to it. It's on its way to us. We could have anything going out there as slow as you want, as long as it's big enough. And if it's far enough away from the Earth, where it has time to deflect it. And I always wondered about the idea of you wouldn't want to send a nuke up to blow it, because then you'd have a bunch of little pieces. But the little pieces run up in the atmosphere, don't they? It's the big ones you got to worry about. Anyway, I just had a question about that. It just seemed like we were looking at it from the wrong point of view. We don't have to catch it. We don't have to have a rocket that goes faster than the asteroid. We could.
You've got to catch up with it as I see it, Sam, because in order to deflect it, F equals MA. And if you really study what that means, to deflect something, you're going to apply a certain amount of force for a certain length of time in order to deflect something. You don't have an infinite supply of force. Your corrective machine, whatever it is going to be applied some relatively small amount of force. I mean, if the thing weighs 50 million pounds and you want to move it 1 foot per second 2 years earlier in some innocuous direction, you're going to apply a force to it in and maybe you're going to apply that force for a week in order to speed it up to 1 foot per second. You're not just going to fly by it, and as you fly by, you set off your bomb. Sounds good. The nuclear bombs that you've seen exploded, when that nuclear reaction takes place in the middle of that bomb, let me drop it. It produces a tremendous amount of neutrons and other high-velocity particles at very high temperature, that's what high velocity means, that strike the nearby air molecules. The air molecules get heated up so much, just like they do on a lightning bolt, that they expand and create the blast. In free space where there is no air, you've got all of these high-speed subatomic particles coming out of that nuclear reaction that do not create a blast. Doesn't create the same effects. You think that a nuclear bomb alongside of an asteroid is going to blast it into pieces. There's no local air for you to heat up to create that shockwave. You're going to create a hot spot on the near side of the asteroid, and that may or may not deflect it. So any of the reasonable deflection techniques of something that's got any real mass to it, you've got to catch up with it, you've got to sit side by side with it, attach your rocket engine to it, apply force from your rocket engine for some period of time in order to accelerate it in some direction. Without catching up with it, I don't think you can do that. And that's the only real protection method for a heavy object that I know of. You've got to deflect it. Blasting it into small pieces, if you could do that, yes, a whole lot of small pieces coming down to the Earth, as long as they're smaller, the biggest ones are small enough, that's a hell of a lot safer. But where is the blast of that shockwave going to come from? If you could dig a hole in the asteroid and put that bomb below the surface of the asteroid, yes. Once again, you've got to be there for a long period of time to do any of those operations. As I see it, KC-1, SAM, K2LIW, you got it, Sam.
Yeah, very interesting, Dick, very interesting. I wasn't thinking about the aspect of pulling alongside of it and pushing it. I was thinking more of a direct ram. It was far enough away. If you rammed it with something, that would make a change. How much of a change, I don't know. And let me see where you have to catch up to it today. I don't know. I think if they had one of those penetrator bombs that we have that goes on several feet below, it would go inside of it, but maybe not big enough because you probably saw something 6 miles across, and that's going to be more enough to take out Cincinnati, so to speak. But, anyway, I appreciate your comeback on it, and there was a point I wanted to bring up in question. I enjoy listening to this. I've been listening for several weeks, and first time I had a chance to comment. So thanks for letting me in the group there. This is KC1SAM. Back to you, and I forget your call. Oh, here we go. K2RIW. Pick it up, please.
Okay, that's Sam in Killingworth, Connecticut, coming through rather well tonight. And welcome aboard. The TechNet has existed since September of 1982, 35 years ago. The TechNet has existed for essentially every single Sunday for 35 years, probably 7,000 hours worth of TechNet. You can review them if you want to by going to the website amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor. 10 or 11 years of the last 10 or 11 years of the TechNet are recorded there by a very enthusiastic guy named Mike, KC2NJI. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back all of those past TechNets if you were so inclined. And there are college professors in New Jersey, among other places, that will tell their electrical engineering students to listen to some of that material to find out what modern-day electrical engineering with hands-on experience is really like. If you want an RF engineer today, you probably have to hire a ham radio operator, because the way we teach radio and wireless technology in our schools does not have a user-friendly, easy, applicable function to it, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. The way we teach electrical engineering, RF, electrical engineering, does not allow you to walk out of that room whistling that tune. You can't walked out of that school with a summa cum laude degree, bachelor degree in electrical engineering, and walked straight into a electrical engineering company and do that function without some number of months of apprenticeship. You can't do that. Whereas a computer engineer, a software engineer, a computer science engineer, there's a medium good chance he can walk out of that school and directly walk into that job. But we don't teach this subject in a user-friendly function. We teach it by way of Maxwell's equations. We think that that mathematics is the base of everything. Well, to a degree it is, but it's too many steps back from the way it's really applied today. That's an opinion. And that whole schooling process is stuck in the paradigm the way they've done it for the last 50 years, and they don't want to change it. AC2IS. Now, Bill was an X-ray analyst. What's your question or comment, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
Hello, Dick. Yeah, this is Bill, AC2IS, and I'm kind of expecting to hear just a plain no answer to this question, but do you know of a good reference design for a handheld radio, HT? Here being that nowadays computers are very small, become stick sized, and you might be able to incorporate full-blown computer into an HT and drive a display and, you know, possibly put a USB interface on it, sort of build in some communication with different modes. But you know, the radio itself, the plain old HT, would be good to have to add all this stuff onto. Is there a good reference design to look at? Can we break for a second and then ask a second question? Second question being, you guys are familiar with CubeSat. You got an inquiry for somebody that's interested in doing a CubeSat project, but he did not mention what project, what goal he actually had for a CubeSat launch. So I was wondering if there were a few projects that you guys knew of that were sort of on deck, things that people wanted to do with CubeSat, things that would be interesting to accomplish. Those are my two questions, AC2IS.
By way of YouTube videos, there's a whole lot of very educational information on any subject you're interested in. I have seen on YouTube videos a number of them labeled CubeSat project, where some school in England, some school in Germany or whatever, has built a CubeSat. In some cases they've got them launched and they're being used. They're out in space making measurements, downloading data, and so on. So if you simply go to a YouTube video and search on the word CubeSat, you're going to find a good number of articles. Now, when it comes to your first question, well, listen, I'm having trouble remembering what the first question was. Give me one word as to what was the subject matter of your first question.
Reference HT.
Yeah, to build the HT yourself would be similar to what happens if I fall in love with a particular a Kenwood 890 or something like that, an 80 through 10 meter rig, and I want to homebrew that. You can buy it with a year's worth of your a week's worth of your salary, but it would take you a year and a half to build it, and after a year and a half you would have this homely looking thing that you could never sell. So where Southeast Asia has made equipment so inexpensive, where you get so much bang for the dollar, buy it. By way of Baofang and Luxong, for $30 you can buy an awful lot of handheld radio these days. By way of the downloadable manual for Luxong, Baofang, Motorola, and all the other handy talkies, you can see the schematic diagram of that radio. That schematic diagram tells you primarily what components with what interconnection are going to give you that radio if you insist on building it or modifying it. Let me drop a clip. I mean, if I wanted to build a very quick and dirty repeater, and I know somebody who has done that, he went for 30-some-odd dollars a piece, bought a pair of Baofeng, set one in the receive mode, set one in the transmit mode, have an interface, a chunk of electronics that he built that turned it on, that acted as the RF-activated switch, put it all in a box with a power supply and a couple of antennas, and he hangs that from a tree at a particular sporting event that he goes to, and therefore it's a local on-site repeater. So to build that hardware of a handy-talkie with your hands would be a huge waste of your man hours of gathering the materials, building the printed circuit board, assembling, and so on, when you can buy it so inexpensively. So you can buy the individual components that you need, and the schematic diagrams will tell you what is located where, so you can modify and tap into those circuits in certain places. So is there a box, is there a book telling you, here's how you design and build your own handy-talkie? I'm almost positive the answer is no. For people like Southeast Asia who are doing that, the exact process, they keep that data close to their chest. But by way of the schematic that you can download and the hardware you can buy, you can get there by another route that's a hell of a lot faster and cheaper in man hours and dollars. AC2IS, K2LIW with a bunch of opinions. Over to you, Bill.
Okay, Dick, I'm looking at the base claims at least to have schematic for a Baofeng UB5R, but I'm wondering, you know, most of the functions are built into a single chip nowadays. I'm wondering if the user interface is going to be in that one chip, because user interface is something that I'd like to replace. So I'm wondering if this is something that I'd be able to interface to with easily with a computer so as to get around on the user interface on a 5R. I guess I'll spend a little time thinking about that. Thanks, AC2IS.
Eric recognized. Yeah, because so much of that high level of integration is all put into that chip, the video, RF, IF, and so on, oscillators, all inside of one chip. To find out what's in that chip, to get a data sheet on that chip, it's a bit troublesome. And to be able to tap into that chip is also going to be troublesome, because you're about to find out that, for instance, when it comes to the modulation scan width, the modulation bandwidth, as a Baofeng UB5R, for instance, lots of people would like to go into the chip and dial it up to a greater modulation index on some of the individual model numbers that they can buy. It appears as though that is burned into the chip, and individual diodes in there were burned out to select those parameters, and you can go back. Can you go back and reset them? The answer might be no. You may have to buy another radio. And as you buy a UV5R, let me drop it. As you buy a UV5R, for instance, depending on what block of serial numbers you buy, it's either set for super narrow or the normal width of modulation. Awful lot of them have very low audio when you're transmitting because they're set to the new FCC mandate of narrowband FM. And to increase that bandwidth on that radio is very difficult. You're way off finding out can you buy an older one which had the wider modulation, because the more modern ones seem to have the narrow modulation, and there are other models. There are other models other than the UV5R. For instance, one of the model numbers that I bought is called a Baofeng 997-Sierra. For whatever reason, I did it as a lot for 30-some-odd dollars. It has full modulation bandwidth. I see what Eric's got to say.
K2IW in the tech net. Yeah, K2IW, K2IW. You can actually get the data sheet on the chip, but which I've done. Actually, the early UV5Is, the ones that you're complaining about, is basically two-chip radio. One chip is the receiver transmitter with some components hung on the outside to generate some power, and the other chip is the interface and controller. Actually, if you're willing to, those that are now, it's not diodes that are burned out, it's built into the software where they set the deviation bandwidth. If you're into, you know, unsoldering some surface mount stuff, you actually can change the modulation depth of that chip, but you can't change the instructions being sent out by the controller because that's all on ROM, that's fixed. So, but, now Bofang learned, actually, if you get the current version of the UV5R, which looks different than the original one, it actually has the right modulation output, and all the radios they're manufacturing at this point now have the ability to choose through software. So the later versions of radios, you can actually load firmware into it. The older ones, you just can't because they didn't learn at that point. K2RWK, 3J.
Okay, it was Bill who asked the original question, so wait a little bit of time, Bill, and go right ahead with your further questions. Eric, ACQIS, K2RAW, second answer.
I think you were passing to me, ACQIS. So it sounds like possibly the chipset of the Baofeng UV5R would be ideal. And then possibly, maybe I could even buy a UV5R and sort of scratch the controller off of the board and try replacing it, maybe building it back into a slightly different case. That by replacing the controller, I could replace the user interface and still use the other chip for transmission. Does that sound right, Eric? AC2IS.
Okay, well, if you don't mind working with surface mount and you want to suck your chip out of it, just be my guest, and then you would have to create your own microcontroller to talk to it. You know, if you're into software and programming, it's a really doable thing. An ultimate waste of time, unless, of course, it's something that you feel strongly about, you know, and having the feeling of accomplishment of doing something ridiculous. But, you know, I mean, if you just need a different case, take the whole board out and put in a different case. But, it's a doable thing, but I can think of better things to do with my time. There actually are now a series of single-chip radios, in essence, which have literally the front end without the filter, of course, all the way through the IF, the audio, the multipliers, the output. There's a set of pins on there for the quick hole, so it, you know, runs on frequency, usually with a little trimmer, so you can get it right, but doable thing, it's just a matter of your personal desire to do it.
Okay, thanks, Eric. Yeah, I understand this would not be an economical project, but there are so many people who don't like the user interface of the radios like the UV5R, and it would be nice to add in some digital communication modes, that it might be a nice hobby kind of project. Thanks for your input, AC2IS.
I'm trying to find the call letters of the guy who did what you're trying to do. I'm not positive, but I think it was Ed, KC2PYT. KC2 Papa Yankee Tango, I think, is the guy who approximately a year and a half ago did what you're about to do. So where he's going down that road to solve the problem, if I've got the right guy, he'd be the right guy for you to get a hold of. He lives somewhere in Suffolk County. I think he lives in Ronkonkoma. He travels on the expressway many nights coming home. You can hear him on the 449-125 repeater at around 4:30, 5 o'clock at night, traveling home. And as I said, he's done that project, if I've got the right guy. I'll keep looking to try to make sure he's the right guy, Bill, because somebody has already gone down the road, solved many of the problems. He's the guy who set up this makeshift repeater, as I'm telling you about, and I'm pretty sure it was a successful project. AC2IS, K2LIW, and the TechNet.